Raising Playful Tots, show number 136. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Raising Playful Tots. I'm glad that you could stop by today. My name is Melitza. Welcome to the Play Space. It's here that we focus on play that we want to see and experience in our homes. We cover play-related topics to inspire, teach, challenge, and lead us to have a great time with these kids so that we can introduce a new play idea or two. So if you're new to the show, welcome. It's good to have you here. And hi to the regular playmates. There's plenty of room, so come join us as we roll down the hill. Now it's lovely and dry out. Last week's show, I shared an interview with Vivian McNenny from The Sociable Homeschooler about looking up and looking forward, a bit of perspective in this season of early childhood. So if you missed that one, pop on over to the blog where you can listen to that show and find the archive of all the shows at raisingplayfultots.com/shows. This week's show, I'm talking to Dr. Roberta Golenkoff about play. We have conversations about the five elements that make up play, what has research proven about the level of play and the variety of play when adults join in, should parents be playing with their children all the time or not, language classes we talk about, clubs and time to play, as well as four-year-olds reading, plus getting past the fear of children failing and falling behind. We had fun talking, and it led off from our last chat that we had, which was on how to have a successful child in school, which was show number 19. Einstein Never Used Flashcards is one of my all-time, hands-down favorite book. It's the one I recommend to new parents or parents with new babies as a gift. It's full of research, ideas, and the best part, activities for us to do, plus things to think about for our play lifestyle. So I was really glad to have the chance to speak to one of the authors today and talk about play. This is a longer episode than normal, and I do a quick wrap up at the end. So I hope you'll stick around, and I'll be right back after this really short break with the interview.
Hi, this is Dan Miller, author of 48 Days to the Work You Love, and you're listening to Raising Playful Tots.
Today, I'm talking to Dr. Roberta Golenkoff. She is a professor at the University of Delaware. She holds the H. Rodney Sharp Chair in the School of Education at the University of Delaware and has joint appointments in the departments of psychology and linguistics. Her research focuses on how children learn language as well as on preschool education and the benefits of play. She's written numerous articles and spoken on play in the early years all over the world. Welcome to the show today.
Thanks so much, Melitza.
Oh, you're welcome. So what is the point of play? This is what we're going to be talking about today.
So can you imagine a childhood, your childhood, where every time you started to play, people said, stop that.
No.
It would have been awful. Because all kids know about is play. They don't know the difference between work and play. They just know that the world is their oyster, and they want to learn about it, and they want to learn about their social partners, too. So it's impossible even to imagine that. Now, with animals, you know, people can do experiments, and they can stifle their opportunity to engage in social play. This is the work of a guy named Suomi, S-U-O-M-I. And when he stifles animals from engaging in social play by not putting them with their peers, they become withdrawn and scared creatures. So, you know, play is so important for us, figuring out our place in the world, figuring out what we like, what we can do, who we are. People describe when they played and suddenly discovered that they were passionately interested in those insects crawling on the ground, and that's what turned into their life's work. as with Edmund Wilson, it's not uncommon for people to link up their later successes with things that they did as children. Play is just so a part of who we are. Primates play, and even non-primates play. If you have dogs or cats, you've seen them running around the house, either with you or with other of their species, or even across species. I had a dog and a cat who used to chase each other around. And it's obviously playful and enjoyment for the species that's taking part in it.
Yeah, I know that you're right. It's just interesting, I think, that we can, as parents, say, oh, the kids are just playing, and kind of pass it off as if it's nothing, really. But there's so much more to it than that.
You are so right. And it's that word just that has unfortunately been taken too seriously by our culture. And one of the reasons that people are putting in the just has to do with the marketplace. So, you know, I'm a capitalist. I live in America, right?
Yeah.
But the marketplace is telling parents what it is they need to do. The marketplace is trying to convince parents that it's just play unless it's accompanied by a fancy electronic device or some toy that you have to spend $75 to buy, which will enhance your child's brain power, you know.
Yeah.
So, it's really the marketplace that's shaping the discussion, which is why I and my colleague, Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, are so determined to get it around that play is really important for kids. It's not the whole story. We can engage in playful instruction in school, especially, you know, through the first few grades. We want to get kids engaged. It's all about engagement. But the marketplace is telling parents they have to buy stuff to have successful kids, and the stuff that they want parents to buy mostly has batteries.
Hmm.
And because in America we think anything with a technological component is a good thing, this may not be unique to America, parents all want to believe the hype because everybody wants to do what's best for their kids.
Yeah.
But in fact, kids do very well without fancy electronic toys that prompt for one right answer, or without iPads, shocking though this may sound, or without mom's cell phone. Not that these things are terrible. They're not, and they have their place. But the marketplace is telling parents just play isn't enough. And that's the message that the science speaks against.
Yeah, absolutely. You quoted a study in your book, Einstein Never Used Flashcards, of two young children, Felix and Minerva, I think is how you pronounce her name.
Yeah.
And that I found that was really interesting to do with the, you know, what's the point of play, and that these children were just playing, and what actually happened with that. I wonder if you can recount a little of that study if you're able.
So I may not remember that specific study, given the book was written in 2003.
Yes.
But I'll be happy to tell you what you see, for example, when you see kids sitting around and playing with blocks, right? And well, the first thing you see, if they're doing this in school, is that there's a social element. You know, playing with blocks is not just playing with blocks. They're talking to each other. They're negotiating. They're coming up with a narrative if they want to build a castle and then have the castle taken over by a foreign army. You know, they're doing all this make-believe stuff, which is stretching their thinking and their view of the world. When they try to align blocks and they fall down, they learn something about physics. They learn something about number. When they realize that to duplicate the turret on the other side, they will need to find the same number of blocks. So they engage in one-to-one correspondence, and they may count at the same time. They learn about shapes, because some of the blocks are triangles, some of the blocks are squares. They become familiar with the properties of these geometric shapes. They're doing a number of things, I could go on, that will feed into, that will serve as the foundation for the kinds of things that they will learn from their parents and then in school. So if you put on a new lens and look at play through this lens and say, what is it that kids are learning by manipulating these materials, by interacting with their peers, by allowing their imaginations to stretch and grow, you can see really wonderful things happening. But again, it is not in the interest of the marketplace, who influences our thinking to a great degree, to help parents see that. They mostly want parents to think that they need objects and artifacts produced by their companies.
Yes.
To have their children thrive. So I urge parents to sit back and have a look at what their children are doing. If they can think about what the elements of learning are that are embodied in the kinds of experiences their children are having. Playing with dolls, it's the same thing. They're practicing roles. They're thinking about what does it mean to be an adult? What does it mean to be a parent and nurturant? And how do I take on that role? It helps them understand social rules. The psychologist from Russia who died an untimely death at 38, Lev Semenovich Vygotsky, love the name.
Yes.
Vygotsky said that kids are a head taller in play, meaning that they examine things that they wouldn't ordinarily think about when they're going through the world and it's not play. It makes them think about the social roles that we all play. It makes them think about how two things are alike and different from something else. It's when they have a chance to reflect. And sometimes the kids who appear to be the most disorganized and running around will have those moments that last for as long as a half an hour, where they're deeply engaged in some play activity. And that's just helping them grow their attention span, which is really important for success in school and in life.
No, absolutely. I think you've made a really good point there for the case of we need to include play and not say that it's just play. And for us as parents, let's talk about us for a little while, about how we can join in with their play. What has research proven about the level of play and the variety of play when an adult actually joins in with the play that's going on?
Okay, so, you know, parents really are their kids' first teachers. If we have conversations with our kids in the context of play, we don't even have to think about it, because the kinds of words that we will use with our children will naturally expand them. One thing we have to remember when we play with kids is not to direct it. Research tells us that if we get too heavy-handed and tell the kid, no, this goes there, put it there, what happens is the kid shuts down, and sometimes the play turns off, and the kid doesn't want to play anymore, because play is not a situation in which children are coerced to do what adults want. Play is the situation that's child-initiated. And parents sometimes say to me when I go around and speak, I don't know how to play anymore. I'm not a kid. And I didn't play that much as a kid, which I find hard to believe. But what I suggest to them is that they just plop themselves down on the floor, wherever their kids are playing or at the table, and start by just describing what their child is doing. And that will get them into it, because if the child sees that they are interested in what they are doing and capturing it in words, the child will probably start talking and incorporate the adult into their play. But the idea is not to take it over. So we have a study with building blocks. We're big on blocks.
Yes.
And we had three conditions in that study. Either we had a condition where we presented dyads, a parent and a child, mostly moms and children, with a pre-assembled block structure, or we gave them just a pile of blocks and said, have fun, or we gave them a picture of a block design to duplicate, like to create a castle or a garage. And it turned out in that last condition, which we called guided play, parents talked to their children in a way that would be very helpful for their children's understanding of spatial language. Terms like above and below and bigger and littler and to the left of and on top of, that's the kind of language that parents don't have to think about using because they have that stuff in their repertoire. But when they're playing with blocks and they use that language and then the child creates the outcome that is described by the language, the child is learning spatial language. There's another study by Shannon Pruden from Florida International University that looked across a lot of these kinds of episodes where parents were talking to kids. And the parents who interact with children and use more of this spatial language have children later on who are better at nonverbal spatial tasks. And this is important for a number of reasons. Your viewers may have heard the term STEM.
Yes.
Which is an acronym that stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. And this is what societies need to move ahead because this is where the new discoveries emerge. So children need to understand about space because a lot of these technologies will require spatial understanding. And it is also the case that knowledge of space correlates with how children do in math. Because if you think about it for a moment, math is very spatial. Like understanding the number line is a very spatial activity. Knowing that 1 is very far from 100 and 50 is in the middle of this number line, that's understanding space. So we have from our own data findings that 3-year-old kids in a task where they are putting designs together and blocks together to match models we show them, we have in our own data the finding that children's ability to put those things together relates to their math scores 1 and 2 years later.
Ah, oh, interesting.
Yeah. So parents really don't realize, I think, the power that they have just by being who they are and hanging out with the kid and engaging in play. Now, I know everybody is so busy that nobody can even imagine sitting on the floor, right? Well, if you look at your watch and you go, okay, it's 8 o'clock. I could do this for 10 minutes. And you follow through and you do it for 10 minutes. That 10 minutes will mean a lot for your kid.
Yeah.
So, you know, they don't realize, I think, how powerful they are. They're really powerful in their child's lives.
I think what you just said was really interesting, that 10 minutes is a good amount of time if that's what you have, and if you have perhaps, if you have longer, great, and if you have less, okay.
Right.
So what you're saying is that children, parents shouldn't be playing with their children all the time, or are you saying that parents should be playing with the children all the time?
Well, you know, first of all, I would never argue that because it would be unreasonable because parents do have things they have to do, like the laundry, making dinner, you know. But a lot of this stuff kids can be incorporated into. I had a mother I was talking to, I think it was yesterday, I met her in a restaurant, and she was telling me that her 3-year-old loves to help her divide the lights and the darks for the laundry, you know.
Yes.
And imagine while they're doing that, they're having a conversation about the colors of the objects, what the objects are. Sometimes you have an object that you can't necessarily identify, like an apron, you know. What is that, Mom? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So even in these everyday activities, like setting the table, you know, kid is doing one-to-one correspondence, putting out the number of plates and forks that correspond to the number of people coming to dinner. If it's done in a fun way, children can help with chores and learn a tremendous amount. Now, in a way, that's a kind of play as well, but it's just that it has this lovely tone to it, that the child believes that they're helping the parent, and they are helping the parent to some extent, but they're also learning as it's happening. And the kind of play where you walk away from the chores, like we talked about a moment ago, with sitting on the floor with your kid while they're doing something, that's a wonderful gift to your child and to you, because your blood pressure is going to go down during the time when you are focused on your child and what your child is doing. So I think we need to talk about how play helps parents, too.
Yes.
Take a little break. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Sit down with your kids. Say, for 10 minutes, I'm just going to focus here. It's wonderful to play with your kid. It's not practical to play all the time. And children need time alone, too.
Yes.
Because when they have that time alone is when they can figure out what they like and what they don't like and who they are. If you go back and think about how you played as a child, let me put you on the spot, Melissa. What did you do as a child when you played?
Oh, we were very into Play-Doh. Absolutely love Play-Doh. We played a lot of that. And my mum made the cold Play-Doh that would go rock hard if you left it out for too long, and that was great. We absolutely loved Play-Doh. We were out on our bikes a lot in the neighborhood. We were able to just ride up and down and do those types of things. I don't remember block play being huge, but we did have lots of Lego.
Great. That's blocks.
Yep.
They're littler, but yes. That's blocks.
Yeah.
So you did spatial assembly things. You were active with your body. That's so wonderful. In America today, we have a problem with obesity that Michelle Obama would like to affect. So in America, we have more kids with type 2 diabetes than we've ever had before. We have kids with essential hypertension. Kids with high blood pressure!
Yes, wow.
And, oh my God, and kids who are overweight. Why is that? It's because there are, in fact, some neighborhoods that are not safe. Where I live in Delaware, there's such a neighborhood where, you know, there are drive-by shootings and stuff like that, and, you know, makes you nervous to let your kid out. But most of the time, I think, parents have been influenced by the media about the frequency with which their children are in danger. Because what goes on the TV news or in the newspaper? It's always, you know, the abductions, the pedophiles. I don't know if, in fact, these have increased in frequency over the years, or if we're reporting them more, or if they appear in the media more, because perhaps they weren't considered appropriate in the past. But we know from cognitive psychology that the more you hear something, even if it's false, the more you believe it's true. So when we hear about these things, it makes us want to keep our kid inside and under our nose, when in fact it may be the case that we have come to believe that the world is a more dangerous place than it really is, and that there are ways to circumscribe our child's freedom outside so that we can feel secure and they can feel secure. Think about the news, you know. Nobody's going to say, oh, Johnny went to school today and had a wonderful time, and then he walked home and played with his friend Johnny. I mean, that's not news.
No.
What's news is the creepy bad stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what we hear all the time.
Yeah, you almost have to reprogram what you're doing and what you are feeding your mind. You have to keep your children safe, and you never expose them into places that wouldn't be. But you also have to think a lot broader than what you hear coming in from news outlets, because their whole way that they are set up is to draw you in and for you to keep coming back. And that can only be done with sensational content. And so it's not sensational content to talk about play and the wonderful things that can happen that way. And so we need to, you know, podcasts and programs like this that share with parents how you can practically do play activities, like you said, find ways of playing with the children so that the adult can get things done, the children get benefits too, and nobody feels the pressure that they have to do too much. As you said earlier, there's so many pressures on parents. They're so busy. And another pressure parents often feel is, I have to do all this stuff with my children, otherwise they're not going to be successful. Whereas that's not the case at all. You shared quite clearly that they can do stuff with us. We can do stuff with them. There should be a variety that's kind of going on inside the house, and not just the only form of play that's good is when I stop my work as an adult and sit with my child for a good amount of time. That's not the only play that goes on. Play does include when they are with us and we are doing something together.
Yeah, that's right. And it can be, as I say, it can be helpful mm-hmm. to you. I mean, if your kid thinks that they're getting to do something that adults do.
Oh, yes.
You know, that's like a big deal.
Yes, absolutely. So,
And, you know, they could, in fact, be helped to realize that they can pull their load, and it can be a learning experience for them, too. So it's kind of the case that every time they interact with an adult who treats them nicely so that they don't shut down, that they learn from that adult's language, from that adult's concepts, and from the way the adult talks about the world. I mean, think about how you learned about social relationships. I remember in my family, I always thought they were too negative, even when I was a kid. And I always wanted to give people the benefit of the doubt. Now, perhaps it was because I was naive, you know, and mm-hmm. I didn't know the ways of the world. But I was kind of socialized to think about relationships in a way that I changed some as an adult. So that when you hear your parents talking about other people and how they get along and what's good and what's bad, you really are learning about how to think about the world and how to think about your relationships. So there's all kinds of stuff that kids get out of interacting with parents, out of eavesdropping on parent conversations. Hmm. Be careful.
Yep. Yes. Yes.
And if you talk to your children in a way that engages them and invites them to ask questions and to talk to you, they will talk to you even later in adolescence when typically kids will sometimes shut down and not share.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So let's talk about play itself. We've talked about what the point is of play, but I noticed that you mentioned that there are five elements that make up play. And I thought that that was really interesting when we actually think about what we class as play and what it's become known as play. If we actually look at those five elements that make up the word play.
The definition of play is very much up in the air because it's a very difficult concept to narrow down. You know how we just talked about setting the table and separating the laundry? Can
yes.
be a playful activity. So that's why there's not that much that you can, like, say, it's absolutely this or it's absolutely that. Okay, typically with kids, play has a fantasy element where they're removed from the day-to-day. Now, they may not always share that with you. My own daughter, who is 31, told me, I think it was a couple years ago, that she used to play this game when she was little where she would make believe that her hand was a family, the fingers representing a family. And this was all going on in her head, and I didn't know it. And she would have the family members interact and go places, you know. So it's often the case that there's a fantasy element. And some of this, again, you can't detect because it's in the kid's head. It's mm-hmm. often the case that kids are experiencing enjoyment when there's play. But think about this for a moment. That doesn't have to mean, ha-ha, you know, they're always, like, laughing. It doesn't have to mean that at all. They can be very sober and serious, as I bet she was when she was doing this fantasy stuff with having the family interact with each other and talk with each other. But nonetheless, she got great enjoyment out of this. Now, think about that. Nobody told her to do that. I didn't know she did that till she was in her 20s.
Yes.
So another element of play is free choice. Mm-hmm. Kids get to pick, and kids get to initiate the kinds of play that they want to engage in. So that's why if a parent takes over, if a parent becomes a director instead of a participant, allowing the child to be the director, the play will often shut down because it's no longer play when it's adults telling the kids what to do in a directive manner. Because one of the key elements of play is children making these choices on their own. Another element is it doesn't have any purpose. I mean, think about, again, you know, building with a tower. Well, you could say the short-term purpose is to put up a tower, or the short-term purpose is to, you know, put the fingers on your hand in a family and talk to them. But it's not a purpose like learning the alphabet.
Yes.
Or learning how to write your name. You know, it doesn't necessarily have an outcome or a purpose in that sense. So kids need the opportunity to engage in self-initiated, self-directed activities for their own enjoyment that often have a fantasy element. And children may or may not engage in language during play. One of the cool things is what Vygotsky called private speech. So you may notice, as I have noticed with my grandkids who are now six, that they will, especially the boy, takes little animals and he acts out scenarios with these animals. And I've noticed that the private speech is when you talk to yourself, but it's kind of out loud.
Yes.
He was doing a lot more of that when he was little. And now that private speech is going inside, it's getting internalized. It doesn't mean he's doing any less fantasy stuff. It's just he's doing it in his head on the plane of thought, as opposed to having to verbalize it. But when you catch kids talking out loud to themselves and playing out little scenarios, it's just delicious. And it helps them to think. And then those thoughts will eventually go inside and they will reduce the amount of that talking out loud they do. By the way, we as adults do the talking out loud thing too. Just give me a task that's really hard.
Yes.
And you'll see my lips moving and I might even talk out loud.
Yeah.
So now you know why kids do it, because manipulating objects and thinking about what you want these objects to be doing takes a lot of cognitive space. And they're thinking out loud while they do it, and later as they gain more capacity, that language can go inside.
That's good. Well, those five elements that you mentioned, I think, are really handy for us as parents to look at when we're thinking about the playful experiences that we are encountering. How are they? How much of them really are playful experiences, and how much of them really are directed experiences that we are expecting them, the children, to be playful in, but they aren't play at all? I think that that's what I really enjoyed about those five elements, is being able to kind of use them as a benchmark, because I think the second element that you mentioned about no purpose, is a problem that you've mentioned earlier in society. We've got so many toys that seem to have a specific purpose that we're supposed to use these for, and then we give them to our children and they are for play, and it kind of clashes with that element. And so, like you said, you can use those toys for some things, but if you're thinking that these are primarily play objects, that they aren't really doing the job of play.
You know, it's so interesting you should say that, because in 2008 we published a study on how parents and experts in child development think about play. So the parents and the experts all agreed that unstructured play, things like playing in the leaves and running in a circle and, you know, the kinds of stuff kids do, was play. But where the adults and the experts in child development disagreed was on these structured activities. So adults were much more likely to think that using flashcards, using a computer program, watching a television show were examples of play, whereas the experts did not consider those to be examples of play. So this notion that there's no purpose and that it's child-directed is what really makes it play. And this is where the bad marketplace, again, is influencing parents, because it's making parents think that these objects created by adults for children, like television programs or flashcards, that those are examples of play, and they're not, because the child is consuming the adult creativity, not creating for themselves, and it has this overt purpose of we've got to teach the kids something. So you're so onto it, and again, parents differ from the experts in what is considered play, influenced by the marketplace, in my view.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's something I think that we have to keep revisiting and keep reminding ourselves of, because it's so pervasive. It just keeps coming at us all the time, and we have to do what's right for our families, but we also have to be mindful of the things that are pressing on and influencing us. I wanted to move on a little bit and talk about classes, because there are so many classes these days everywhere for young children, and we're primarily today talking about the under fives, but you can take them to anything: sensory play, painting, dance, gym classes, Lego classes, swimming classes, you name it, there are all sorts of classes. That's great in a way, because you've got choices. And as parents, we take them to these sessions, and I know of lots of parents that feel that they take them to these sessions so the play at home doesn't have to be the same. We don't have to worry so much about free play. Why, when we have all of these activities, when they have the right equipment at the local gym, there's no mess in my home, and qualified people over there to do it, do we need to still think about having free play at home?
So, you know, that's such a great question. And again, the marketplace has led parents to believe that if their children can't speak French by the age of two, they've missed the boat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was told about a baby shower. This is a true story, where the theme of the baby shower was learning foreign languages. And everybody brought some kit or book or DVD or something that had to do with teaching babies foreign languages. Now, to me, that was unbelievable, because everybody who bought something of that nature was wasting their money, and the marketplace had somehow convinced parents that this kind of language stuff, where you expose the kids to many different languages through toys or speak and spell, somehow that was going to teach a kid foreign language. You want your kid to learn another language, and you're in an all-English household, and you can afford to hire a nanny, find somebody who can come, or not a nanny, somebody who can come and interact with your child for a bunch of hours a week in another language. That's how your kid is going to learn another language. Mm-hmm. Language is learned in the nexus of social interaction and not from these disembodied devices. So some of these classes can be wonderful, and kids can really enjoy them. They can enjoy these gym things or Lego things, although I don't know why you have to pay to go to a Lego class. There are many things like swimming. Oh, that's a wonderful thing. You want to get your kids to know how to swim. That's for their safety. But you have to make choices. What does your kid really need? For example, when my kids were little, they were invited to join a dance class that took place at a country club, which I would not go near personally, in my area, that was training children. It was like from the 1950s, training children how to interact with each other politely and engage in the foxtrot. I don't know what they were doing, but it was not something I felt my children needed. And I was quite happy to say thank you so much for inviting them, but I'm going to pass. So you as a parent have to make your choices. You have to decide, is it more important for my kid to go out and to be exposed to a French class once a week, although the child is unlikely to remember much or to learn much of the language, or to play at home, unfettered? Now, we've gotten ourselves in a position, Melissa, it's really interesting. Because we have so much junk that we throw at kids, and because we take them to lessons, and believe me, I took my kids to lessons too, we can get ourselves in a position where children expect to be entertained all the time and expect to have the structure. Mm. There was an article in the New York Times several years ago about kids who were sent to summer camp, and they stood around and looked at each other. This is like on the first day, second day, because they had no idea how to play together. I mean, to me, that was so sad.
Mm-hmm.
So you often hear, you know, our modern day kids say, bored, you know, because they're waiting for the adult to find them some activity, because that's kind of what they've gotten used to. That's not good for kids. You want kids to use their imaginations and to learn how to keep themselves occupied, happy, and busy. So your kids should have some time to do that on their own. And, of course, you can make suggestions. You know, this is with my grandkids. They're always saying, can we watch a show? Right? Because they want to watch television. Because television is so seductive.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you're entertained. And, again, you're consuming somebody else's creativity. And you're sitting and getting involved in a story. You know, I'm not saying turn off the tube and never let your kids watch. But I love how my daughter-in-law say, no, no more television. Go play.
Yeah.
And the kids have to find things to amuse themselves. And in doing so, they're stretching themselves. And they're learning about their environment. And again, what they like to do, what they don't like to do. They're interacting with each other. They're twins. They're building scenarios together. I mean, I've seen on a videotape they made for me where they went down into the basement, which is a playroom. They must have played for an hour together, creating a scenario about visiting the doctor.
Yes.
And they went through, so see what they're doing? They're rehearsing what happens in their lives and what the roles are that people play. Patient, doctor, nurse, parent. They're figuring out how the world works by reenacting this stuff in play. And you can notice how they, you know, will sometimes correct each other. No, that's not what doctors do. They do it this way, right?
Yes.
Because teaching each other, you know, what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And they're negotiating. And we all know how important it is to learn the skills of negotiation.
Yeah.
Because nobody's going to work in a vacuum. Everybody's working in teams out there in the world. So where are they going to get that if they don't have an opportunity to play with peers?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And so should we talk a little bit about play deprivation and how would we notice it? Because I'm sensing that there are lots of families that have play established in their home, but we all define play so differently. So how
right.
would we notice that we have play deprivation perhaps going on in our homes?
You know, that's such an interesting question. And it has a lot to do with who the children and who the parents are. So, you know, we come in with different temperaments. Some of our temperament stuff is hardwired. So if you have parents who are nervous types, you may be a nervous type kid yourself because you may have come in wired that
mm-hmm.
way. So it's hard to pull apart what a play deprivation would look like as opposed to whether the individual personality differences that you have are manifesting themselves. Because one of the things I would want to say is if a kid seems anxious, maybe because the kid isn't having an opportunity to play, but some of that can also come from, again, their temperament that they came in with. Kids need an opportunity to process the experiences they've had. So what do I mean? So imagine you scold your child. Have you ever seen your child run over to their stuffed animal and they uncannily reproduce your voice,
yes.
right? And
yes.
say exactly the same thing to the stuffed animal? Now, the wise parent will recognize that the child is not making fun of the parent because the child really isn't capable of that. What the child is doing is attempting to understand the reason that they were scolded and thinking about it in that kind of talk out loud way. So if kids don't have a chance to spend some time alone and process the kinds of experiences that they've had, not necessarily negative experiences, positive experiences too, then, you know, I think they would be a bit nervous, a bit sensitive. Just like we would if we never had any free time.
Mm.
It's so important for us. You know how parents often feel when they get to go away for a little while without their kids, like they can exhale.
Yes.
And it's because, you know, being away on your own allows you to focus in on yourself a little bit. And you're never doing that when you're a parent, right? You're always thinking about what you need to do for others. The kid needs that time. The kid needs to focus in on their own feelings and experiences, too. So I think children who have an opportunity to play are going to be more relaxed and easier to get along with than those who don't.
Yeah. No, that's good. And so if we move along in the ages now and we're thinking about children that are going to school, perhaps more of a formal setting, I'm thinking of children that are, you know, 4, 5, 6 year olds, reception, kindergarten age children. Why do they need play breaks? Because I know many parents wonder, well, when they were at preschool or when they were at home, we could play, but now we're at school, we should be doing school-based stuff, and that's not the same as what we did at home. So why do they need play breaks?
Okay, so the best way that I can answer that question is to tell you, I have a son who is now 34, and when he was studying for his bar mitzvah, I decided, because I had never had training, that I wanted to learn to read Hebrew. So I hired a tutor to come. And it was, I think it was an hour session, and you would think that, I mean, I have a PhD, right?
Yes.
You know, an hour focusing on Hebrew, like, what's the big deal, right?
Yes.
I actually wrote an article about it for one of my academic newsletters, because I felt like a bright but learning disabled child. And I would literally, Melissa, I'm not kidding, I would literally sit and sweat, you know, because I was trying so hard, but it was really, really hard for me.
Yes.
Now, if you're a little kid and they're engaging in instruction and you have to focus, it's really, really hard for you.
Yeah.
So that really gave me some insight into how when you start something new, now, you know, as adults, we don't do it that much, so we don't have a sense of it. But when you start something new and you want to learn and you want to be good, it takes great cognitive effort. And the research tells us, there's a guy named Anthony Pellegrini who, for example, has written a book on recess, that kids need to have breaks. And even more so than we. I mean, we can push through, right?
Yeah.
In other words, when my Hebrew lesson was starting to get to me, I didn't throw my pencil. You know,
yes.
I didn't have a breakdown. I didn't cry. But if I was a younger kid and I had to focus for like an hour on something totally new, it would be exhausting.
Yes.
So when people take breaks for recess, and we also know that doing physical things is a wonderful kind of break for kids and helps them to focus more when they come back than a sit-in-the-seat break.
Yeah.
Now, there's research on all this, and research that shows that when frequent breaks are taken, kids are in a better position to put the thinking cap back on and focus. And under the No Child Left Behind, which has not been renewed but is not going to go away overnight in America, it was usually the kids who needed the breaks most, like in the low-income schools, who were being drilled, who had recess taken away.
Yeah.
You know, it just makes absolutely no sense, you know.
Yeah.
We turn kids into vessels where we try to pour knowledge in, but that's not the way it works. Kids need breaks.
Yeah.
They need to run around, they need to play, and then they come back refreshed and they learn more, and that's what the research tells us.
Yeah. Well, I think that part of that is the fear of failing, that there is just this thing now, the fear of failing, you know, falling behind. And how do we get past that fear of falling behind? Because I remember you quoted a mother saying, if she's just playing, she might be wasting precious moments. when she could be learning, and I don't want to hold my child back. How will I feel when all the other kids are ahead of my child? Now, I don't think that she is unique in that feeling.
I feel
a lot of parents have this feeling that if the children are, quote, just playing, that that somehow they're not going to be as equipped for doing other things.
I know, and think about that. If it feels like it goes against what you really believe and what you experienced as a kid, you wouldn't be wrong. It is, it once again, the marketplace making people feel like we have to rush our children. We have to push them, or again, they will fall behind. There is very little evidence, for example, that four-year-olds need to know how to read. And there are many parents who are like trying to get their kid to learn to read. What's a kid going to read? The newspaper? What's the rush? You know? So it's the case that when you talk about fear of falling behind, it's not a fear a child has. Child doesn't know. It's the fear that the parent has. Now, look, I'm not going to make fun of this because I was a parent too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody wants their kid to go into school prepared and well-behaved and to know what's going on in the classroom. Nobody wants to disadvantage their children. So I am not unsympathetic to this at all. But again, it's the marketplace that's convincing us that we have to do special stuff to get our kid ready. There was this guy, Robert Pitcher, who was selling a kit called My Baby Can Read.
Yes.
Now, they did an expose, and I call it an expose on purpose, on the Today Show about it, and they called to interview me. Me and about 20 other academics who do research in early learning were outraged and appalled by this kit, which tried to make nine-month-olds into parrots by having them learn to read when there is no evidence that children who are early readers are tremendously advantaged, when parents would likely torture themselves and their children to try to make this happen because many parents who spent over $200 on this thing would then write in and say it didn't work.
Yeah.
So the marketplace has us convinced that the earlier, the better. And it's not always true. Children will read when they're ready to read. Now, let me give you another example. Finland. Finland turns out to be at the top of the international tests that are given in adolescence to kids around the world. Guess when Finland starts formal school? Seven.
Hmm.
And we have parents pushing kids to learn to read when they're four, signing kids up for computer science play school, preschool. I mean, we don't have to push kids. They will learn the foundational stuff that they need to prosper in school with. They will learn that from interacting with parents, from going to places that are really exotic, like the supermarket and the pharmacy, and being able to ask questions and having their parents point things out and talk to them. What's that purple vegetable? Oh, that's an eggplant. What's an eggplant? Does that mean it's an egg? No, it's not an egg. You know, so these are the kinds of conversations and things that people can do with their kids. Go out at night with a flashlight. Let the kid hold the flashlight and see how much the kid learns. So we don't need to push kids, and it's often the case that we make kids feel bad about learning and about themselves by buying that preschool tutoring. There's preschool tutoring now where the pencils are bigger than the children. Now, again, I understand we have a junky economy that we can't rely on, and no parent wants a child who could be let go from a job or won't get into a fine school, although there are many, 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 many fine schools. You know, I get it. I really get it. But pushing our kids is not the way to go. If you follow a child's interest, that's one thing. Like, Many kids have an interest in dinosaurs. Wonderful. Feed it. Or snakes. Feed it. Take out books. Go to the zoo. Do whatever it is that interests your kid and help them widen their interest too.
Today I'm talking to Dr. Roberta Golenkoff. She's a professor at the University of Delaware. She holds the H. Rodney Sharp Chair in the School of Education at the University of Delaware and has joint appointments in the departments of psychology and linguistics. Thanks for coming on the show today.
I have had such a good time with you, Melissa.
No problem.
Can I move in with you, Melissa? You have so much fun.
We will have to talk again, for sure.
Thank you.
I'll be right back after this short break.
Take care.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'll speak to you again soon.
Oh, Melissa, you're so much fun, really.
No, it's been great.
This is Dr. Laurel Hutchison of Play Doctor Mom, and you are listening to Raising Playful Tots.
I'm really glad that I got to talk to Dr. Roberta Golenkoff this week about play. Just a quick catch up here on what's been going on. I've taken a break from blogging at the moment and focusing on some new projects as well as some more offline work. And I've been facilitating a Simplicity Parenting group in my local community and absolutely loving it. It's been a lot of fun. And I've also promised myself less online time and earlier to bed. So it's been so much better for all of us because of that. It's so easy as we're raising our playful tots to put our own needs on the back burner. And I'm so glad at this moment I could focus and redirect myself a bit more and do some of the things that I just needed to get done. I've even started running again, and boy, am I stiff. Baby steps, right? Baby steps. I was interviewed recently by Vivian McNenny as well, and we had a lot of fun because I interviewed her for the show that we had last week, and then she interviewed me right afterwards. So we both interviewed each other for our shows. It was a lot of fun to being on the other side and being asked the questions instead of asking the questions. That was a lot of fun. I'll have the link for that in the show notes for you to go over there and be able to have a listen and to be able to visit her show and see what you think. So that's about it for this episode. Thank you so much for sticking right through to the end here with us and for listening to Raising Playful Tots. What stood out for you in this show? Or maybe there was something that Dr. Roberta Golenkoff said that really resonated with you and you thought, you know, that's it. That's exactly how I've been feeling or that's what I've been thinking. Check out the small group questions that I've added to this episode so you can talk to your spouse, your partner, your friends, your family. You can talk about what we've been talking about on the show. You'll have something to work with there. You can download these small group questions at the website. You never know who else feels about play until you start having the conversation. For show notes, links to what we've been talking about in the show, including the small group questions, to leave a comment about how you felt about the show, something that really resonated with you, visit the website at raisingplayfultots.com/136. That's the number 136. And that's the show episode. You can reach the voicemail by going to raisingplayfultots.com/feedback. And there, if you call in, it's a free call voicemail. I don't answer, so you can leave a message if you want, and perhaps that'll be played on the show, or if you have a message that you just want to give to me. If you like the show, please help spread the word by telling your friends, leave a review for us on iTunes, give us a thumbs up on Stitcher or your favourite podcast mobile app. You can find us pinning on Pinterest, you can like us on Facebook, and you can join in our slow parenting, simple parenting community on Google+. You've been listening to Raising Playful Tots, show number 136. Come over and play next week. Until then, find time for some unplugged play. Join with me each week as we share, learn, and laugh together about making the most of early childhood playtime. Goodbye!